911, what's your emergency?
Help! My boyfriend's been cut up into little pieces.
We're sending an RA unit right to your location, ma'am.
Oh, that won't be necessary. Is that okay?
I like that. I thought that was good.
Good.
Also, I like that the more of these that we do, the less incentive there is to, like, make each one perfect.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you know, it's just
another
one. I mean,
listen, if it's a one-take wonder, it's a one-take wonder.
Exactly. And that felt pretty one-take wonderful.
You know, my acting skills improve every time we do one of these.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, I was feeling it. I was honestly feeling the emotion of the scene. I thought it was very believable. Yeah.
Like I took you there?
I was taken there.
Welcome back to the First Risk Podcast. Today, we discuss Season 1, Episode 6, Heartbreaker. Is this our first, or it's definitely our first Valentine's Day episode. I was thinking, is this also the last Valentine's Day episode? I can't think of any other season that has one.
I can't remember any others. No, because they do like themed episodes sometimes. Like they've done a couple Halloween episodes, a couple Christmas episodes. Mm-hmm. But like, I think this is the only Valentine's Day episode. Which is strange, given all the romance on this show.
Right, but I was thinking, I think it might just be because of the schedule they air, because this first season, I think, was actually like a mid-season hiatus show where they aired during, like, starting in January. But now they do the more conventional, like, September through May or June thing, and they usually go on hiatus throughout, like, January, February. So I guess they just haven't had the opportunity.
They're just fucking about to. I mean, like where we are in season 8, they're just about to go on hiatus and we're going to be left with...
How are we going to survive?
No 911 for like over 100 days. Meanwhile, a lot of stuff is going to happen in that time.
Yeah, dude, we're going to have to survive this inauguration sans 911.
Oh, bro, it's about to get so, so bad. Like, honestly, just enjoying the rest of 2024 just like for like mental health's sake.
But you know what? That's why we have this podcast, so that we can always have 911 on the brain.
Right, right. No, that's true. That's true. Honestly, I've been feeling more in touch with this show since we started doing this, because like there would be like lull periods for me where like I wouldn't think about it for like a couple of weeks or something like that, or it would sort of escape me for a little bit while I focus on other things. But like working on this podcast is like... It's like made me fall in love with the show all over again. And I'm like,
well, yeah, we have to be like consistently into it. And also I've been enjoying like rewatching it in this very mindful way that we have to do for the podcast, because I would take like sporadic notes throughout my last rewatch for my video I was making. But like now I'm taking very attentive notes for every single episode and really paying attention, which is kind of a more engaged watch through than I've done before.
Yeah, I agree. I felt the same way when I was watching through Teen Wolf for my video back in the day. I always take really detailed notes whenever I'm doing like a video on like a big subject like that. And I feel like you learn so much more about the show. You see all the details. You see all the sort of the seams, and like it's almost like you get sort of like a peek behind the curtain sometimes when you like sort of start to notice some mistakes or some little continuity errors, or you just like get a little biography on all the characters and everything. It's like you can sort of put yourself in the production room.
Right.
So do we want to dive right into episode 6, Heartbreakers?
I think we should. And speaking of diving, this couple's plane sure took a dive in the opening scene.
My God. This opening scene.
This man deserves to be in prison.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Ladies, would you marry a man who pretends that the plane he's flying you in is going down as he proposes to you?
Just if you don't have a definitive answer right away, just picture this. You're in a crop duster, flying above the hills of LA County.
Perhaps Frank Sinatra's Fly Me to the Moon is even playing in the background.
Perhaps even, you know? And your man's a pilot, right? And he, you know,
he's had his pilot's license for, quote, all of a month.
All of a month. And he's taking you out into the sky. And then the engine starts to fail because you're flying a piece of shit crop duster that would be better suited over like a flat grassy plain, right? And as that happens, he's having you flip through a binder. A literal binder, an instruction manual to try and land the plane. And on the instructional page for what to do if the engine fails while you're flying over LA, 9/11 is fresh in your memory. it on the instructions, it asks you, would you marry this man? Is he the love of your life? And then suddenly the engine starts working again and he pulls out a ring. I would have killed him where he sat.
Yeah, I would have to say no.
Yeah. Is that romantic to anyone?
Apparently it was romantic enough to this girl because she does ultimately say yes.
But first.
Yes, the crux of this call is after he scares her like that, she then, even though the plane is fine, she starts going into cardiac distress of some kind. Mm-hmm. So he calls 911. He's like, I think my girlfriend's having a heart attack. Of course, our girl Abby is answering the call. Mm-hmm. She says, you know, do you have a way to... Oh, she says what? She's dispatching medics to him. But then he's like, no, I'm in a Cessna flying over LA.
So she has him do an emergency landing on a golf course, right?
Which they apparently did not even bother to clear the golf course before letting him do this, because there are people like running away as the plane is landing.
It was like that scene in North by Northwest. It was like,
yeah,
like literally like golfers running in all directions as this plane comes down on like the fucking putting green. It's like absolutely insane.
This was just sticking out to me in contrast to, you know, not to bring up season 8 again, but mm-hmm. opening of season 8, we have this scenario where like Athena's trying to land a plane and they make this whole big deal out of like, okay, we're going to clear a section of the freeway. They yeah. have to do all this like logistics stuff to get that area clear. But in this case, apparently they did none of that.
People who play golf are acceptable losses.
Honestly, when you put it like that, I agree. I'll take it. You're right.
And it was a hole in one. Fuck him. And it was a hole in one. And then, the 118 meets them on the putting green. And
they assume she's gone into cardiac arrest. And I think they're about to inject her with what? Epinephrine?
No, I don't know what kind of medication it was. She mentioned it by name. I should have
written
it down.
They're about to inject her with something when suddenly Buck gets a call from Abby. Once again, inexplicably answers the call.
Yeah.
Lucky that he did, but it's kind of crazy that he does this like right as they're literally in the middle of helping a woman who's apparently gone into cardiac arrest. But he answers the call from Abby. He's like, Abby, I really can't talk right now.
Yeah, no, this is the first time where he's like, Abby, I'm actually on a call. This is important. This is not the time.
And yet he still answered the call. But anyway, it turns out to be good that he did. She says, listen, I just took that call. I found out from the girl's doctor that, you know, she's on this thyroid medication, mm-hmm. and Buck tells that to Hen, and she realizes that what they're about to inject her with could do some damage, so instead, they do something else. They deduce that she has broken heart syndrome, which, yeah. you know, cardiac event brought on by a stressful thing.
Yeah.
Thanks, boyfriend. So, you know, they are able to get her back.
Yeah. What exactly do they do to get her back again? I can't remember.
I think they like inject her with a different thing.
Yeah.
You know, we're not doctors. we're not paramedics.
We just watch Grey's sometimes, you know.
Yeah, I knew the word epinephrine, but that's about as far as my expertise goes.
Yeah. So she wakes up, she's revived essentially, and some ungodly reason she says yes, and she puts the ring on her finger, and then at least thank God she stands up for herself a little bit and slaps him across the face.
She also smacks him. Mm-hmm. This was another moment, I have to say, where I kind of felt like the way Oliver Stark said, and she smacked him, sounded British to me. It's like the words themselves didn't sound British, but he said it in sort of an English, like, intonation, if that makes sense.
Interesting. I think you're more sensitive to the Britishisms coming out than I am because of your time in London.
What can I say? I mean, I'm practically one of them.
You were embedded in these people's territory for so long.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Well, we've seen on the internet in the last couple of weeks, you know, a lot of Western women are finding out about the Korean 4B movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching this and I was just thinking, this is why we need this. These men need to be humbled.
Yeah, it's like at times I have like no comment on that situation because I truly don't know how I feel about it, and it doesn't mm-hmm. like apply to me specifically, so I haven't really thought that hard about my personal whatever. But yeah, it is, sometimes you're reminded, you know, when people say things like your body, my choice, when men pretend that the plane is crashing to propose to you, you're like, maybe it is all men.
Yeah.
No.
Although honestly, if we were going to find the solution to getting straight men, and honestly, men of all orientations to stop fucking around, I don't know. I think maybe we would have found it by now. I don't know.
It's true. I mean, that's part of what's so bleak. All the discourse I'm seeing on Twitter would have you believe that men are being radicalized because they saw a woman say, boys go to Jupiter to get more stupider. You know what I mean? It's like, is it because they saw a few tweets saying that men suck, or is it because they actually had a deep yearning to subjugate women?
I think it's the latter. I think they're just really vile people. And I honestly think one of the only political strategies left to dealing with them is just like shaming and ostracizing.
Yeah, stigma. It's like these people, if they are as lonely and isolated as they claim, like they want social acceptance, and we can't give that to them if they're going to act that way. Yeah, I'm a big proponent of that.
I am too. I like that we're projecting the incel narrative onto this man who now has a fiance.
Right. He's not like the example.
He's the conduit for the greater conversation.
But yeah, I'm trying to, I don't know. I don't want to just depress people with, this is supposed to be our escapism.
This is our escapism.
Really happening in the world.
We're going to leave the world out of this and just talk about 911 from
exactly.
2018. A simpler time.
Then from there, we go to an Abby, Carla, and Abby's mom scene. They're making Valentine's cookies.
Yeah.
It seems like Patricia is having a little lucidity. She's doing okay in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
And Abby is sort of talking about how she likes Valentine's Day, and she kind of wishes that someone, maybe Buck, would take her out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just want to take a moment to call attention to the fact that Carla praises Abby's hair, so she has the hair of an angel.
Yes, there's a hair moment.
Undeniable truth, and I'm glad that Connie's hair is getting recognition, because that shit should be insured for like $10,000.
It probably is. Well, did you also notice the moment in this scene shortly after that when Carla, she says something along the lines of like, if he doesn't take you out, then sayonara, fire boy.
Oh, no. Were you just like getting flashbacks to sayonara, Miles Hollingsworth?
Yes. Wrote it in my notes, all caps. I'm so excited that we now have a 911 counterpoint to my favorite line from Degrassi, The Next Generation.
Yeah, speaking of conservatives.
Tristan from Degrassi, how the mighty have fallen. And by the mighty, I mean the least liked character from Degrassi.
Yeah, now
but
I,
it's
now
like,
I don't.
I was always going to bat for the actor because he got so much hate just for playing a character on a show, which,
yeah,
as you know, is like a fandom pet peeve of mine. It's like, mm-hmm, it's not the actor's fault. But now, that's over. I have no more reason to defend him. He's a,
yeah,
Trump supporter.
Fuck him. Honestly, just fuck him.
Fuck him. When I say all men, I'm including Tristan from Degrassi.
Tristan Milligan. And that older brother of his. We haven't forgotten about his white supremacist ass.
Oh, God. Both Milligans from Degrassi are crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you're Canadian. Like, how are you not embarrassed?
They're just as racist as us, Jane. They're just...
Well, yeah, but I mean that they would be so... like involved specifically in our electoral stuff is like, what are you even doing?
Right. It's like, don't you guys have your own election coming up? Like, why aren't you canvassing for your own guy?
Yeah, like, you know? Fight for, like, your own racist politicians.
But
yes, we cut to Buck and Bobby kind of having their own Valentine's Day discussion. They're, mm-hmm, like closing a fire hydrant.
Yeah.
And Buck is doing classic Buck 1.0, very like fuckboy mentality. He's like, I don't get why Valentine's Day exists. It's just for women to get men to go spend a bunch of money on them or something.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's like red pillish. It's like just this this anti-V-Day romance screed. And it's like, where is this coming from, dude?
It is a bit red pillish. He's, you know, he was probably in some wacky online forums in 2018. But
yeah,
luckily he had a diverse enough group of firefighter besties to pull him out of that world. The love of a beautiful older woman.
I wouldn't be surprised if his, like, YouTube recommended feed was, like, pushing, like, some, like, Ben Shapiro clips or something onto his
timeline.
Oh,
you know he was watching Jordan Peterson.
Oh, my God.
He was like, this guy's the smartest guy in the world.
Dude, after the fucking, like, Zachary Levi meltdown we've seen happening, like, extended meltdown, Like, I can't even, like, think about that right now.
I know. We've accidentally brought up real world radicalization of men a little too much in this episode so far for my liking.
We just started. It's been 20 minutes.
Luckily, Buck has a positive older male role model in his mm-hmm. life to steer him away from this. Because Bobby pushes back on this and he's like, I don't know, I know a lot of women who don't like Valentine's Day and plenty of men who do. And he talks about how he's a big fan of Valentine's Day, which I thought was kind of cute. They end this conversation with a little exchange where Buck's like, I bet you really miss your wife on Valentine's Day. And Bobby says, I miss her every day, Buck. Miss her every day.
Miss her every day. You know what this scene reminded me of more than anything? Was the Klain coffee shop scene from the Glee Valentine's Day episode from season 2.
Yes, silly love songs.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And
so are you implying that this reads as a setup for a romance between Buck and Bobby?
Listen, daddies are in, and that's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
No, I wasn't even remotely going there. Damn you for...
You know, I mean, you compare a scene of two people to Klain, I'm going to assume you're setting them up romantically.
I think, listen, there's shared DNA between these shows. And if anything, I was just thinking maybe the idea is a little recycled. I don't know. One person hates Valentine's Day. The other one loves it. It's classic.
True. That dynamic in itself could be a retread. This episode was directed by Bradley Bwecker.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Also, is that how you say it? Bradley Bwecker?
Oh, I have no idea. How are you supposed to say it? Did I just fuck that up?
No, that makes way more sense than what I've been saying in my head, which is Bradley Bwecker.
No, that actually sounds more legit than Bwecker. That sounds ridiculous now that I say it again. Oh, well, now I don't know. This is such a struggle for us because both of us initially thought Tim Minear was pronounced Tim Minear, which I'm sorry, but makes more sense. In my opinion, like on a spelling level and a sound level.
Yeah, Minear makes more sense. And it sounds better to like hear. But like we also both come from the experience of having like names that are kind of hard to pronounce.
Yeah, yeah. But I swear there were a couple moments in my 911 video where I had like trained myself to say Minear for the entire video. And I still had a couple points where I just accidentally said Minear that I had to like dub in later.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
I had to re-record lines.
Oh no. And then we go from, of course, from Bobby like saying, you know, miss his wife every day and all that stuff to guess who's back? Back again.
Chimney.
Chimney's back. Tell a friend.
Cue the air horns.
and this incredibly gauche fucking cake.
Oh, I love it. This whole scene feels like they're trying very hard to like kind of convey like realistic firefighter fraternal energy. You know, there are a few moments that remind me of this. And I feel like part of it is like the dark humor of that cake kind of feels like real to me mm-hmm. in a way, like the sort of jokey thing they have with each other. Like they would have a cake where they've got licorice rebar sticking out of Chimney's head.
Do you remember, okay, not to bring it back to Glee again, because we just brought it up, but do you remember that episode where the shop teacher, it was Acapella's, the shop teacher gets his thumbs cut off, and they bring him the cake that says two thumbs up.
Two thumbs up.
This is like the light inverse of that. This is like the positive inverse of that situation.
I had forgotten about that. This show really does have a lot of echoes to Glee, actually.
Including spoken ones now that they've actually
yes, this show was produced in the post-Glee world.
Mm-hmm. Like a lot of things.
Well, then there's also in this scene the other thing that felt like, you know, their attempts at real life firefighter humor, when Bobby's trying to light the candle and he's like, does anyone have a match? And then he's like, seriously, a house full of firefighters and nobody has a match? And then we cut away. It like feels like, you know, that feels like a real firefighter dad joke kind of thing.
Yeah. I just loved Chimney's little line, like, I don't remember what the setup was, but he goes...
He says, I've realized how much I really need you guys. Like I need a hole in the head. Yeah, that also felt like that.
He's so funny.
He is.
And I love that they, and you mentioned this in your video, but I love that they just hand waved away any sort of like...
Oh, yeah.
Any like long-term injuries or like complications he would have from this. By just saying, oh, the doctors kept saying it was a miracle.
Yeah. Doesn't need to be real. You can just say you're a medical miracle. Yeah. And it is insane that this is, what, presumably like a month or two later, and he is totally fine, cleared to be back at work after getting a hole in his head.
Only a whisper of a scar on his forehead, like...
Literally, like the tiniest little pink mark.
Then, of course, when Bobby is downstairs getting his little lighter or his little book of matches or whatever it is, he meets Abby for the first time.
Abby walks in wearing the cutest outfit ever, looking so good. She's got these like dark, wide leg, high-waisted pants. Adorable. Yeah. She's paired it with like this like kind of low-cut V-neck white, like lightweight sweater. I'm not even that into V-necks normally, but this was so beautiful. It's just one of those like casually elegant outfits. So amazing. Like, she knew that she was walking into this firehouse and going to wow everybody. So she gets there. Buck's excited to see her. He's introducing her to people. She brought cookies. I did note there's this line where, you know, he's introducing her to everybody and he said, "This is Abby Clark, LA's fiercest 911 dispatcher." And I was like, no offense, but like, did he have to say that in such a gay way?
Do you think he meant it in the gay way? Do you think he like watched...
I don't think he did, but I think like his bisexual subconscious made him say that, because he could have said like LA's finest 911 dispatcher, strongest.
But the boy kisser really jumped out.
But he has to say fiercest.
The fiercest. With a snap.
Like, okay.
A little wiggle in his hips, too.
I'm not trying to, whatever, pigeonhole him into anything. It was just like, wow, okay. Interesting way of putting it.
And this is where we actually get a really interesting piece of, like, I don't want to call it a continuity error. It's just an interesting, like, little thing with the, like, the implications of the timeline now, because we now know that Abby and Tommy, who used to work at the 118 for many years, were like in a relationship to the point of like being engaged and almost getting married.
Right.
And so Hen and Chim, who worked alongside Tommy and presumably a lot of the other people at the 118 who we don't know, they all don't know her. Like, they're all meeting her for the first time?
Here's my two cents, because I've seen some people pointing this out as a so-called plot hole. I don't think it's a plot hole. I just think it has the funny implication of Tommy was so, like, emotionally distant and not fully in this relationship that he literally didn't even bother introducing her to his coworkers. I think he was, like, totally work-life, home-life separate.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Honestly, that's a good read on it, and probably the one that like makes it's kind of the only explanation, and it is in line with Tommy's character.
Yeah, I mean, he just seems like a kind of closed off guy, and I mean, especially, you know, I'm not even trying to say this in a Tommy sucks kind of way. Like, you could argue that it's like because he was closeted, like he was being weird in this relationship or struggling to find himself in that. So maybe he just wasn't feeling it enough to introduce people to her, which sucks for Abby, obviously.
But we can get, I guess, some clues from, like, I guess, Buck and Tommy's relationship, where I don't think we ever saw, you know, Buck meeting Tom. Like, we never even, like, heard about, like, Buck meeting Tommy's coworkers or anything. Like,
that's a good point. He didn't bring him to, like, the air support people at all, even though Tommy was always being brought to the 118 stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting how it sort of only goes one way with him.
Which could mean nothing.
Which could mean nothing.
Anyway.
When Abby shows up, there is this underlying tension between her and the rest of the 118, especially Hen. You know, Hen's kind of, like, sussing her out and all that.
Well, it kind of seems like everyone there is sort of in their head being like, how did Buck bag this woman?
Yeah.
I mean, Chimney says outright, he's like talking to Bobby, watching Abby walk away. He's like, so I get dumped when I get rebar through my skull and Buck gets to get with her.
I'm glad that the fandom's finally coming around to this take too, because Connie Britton is one of the most gorgeous women on the planet.
Like, Buck's a catch, but let's not act like he was the catch in this relationship.
Yeah, no, Abby was settling. Abby was definitely settling.
Literally. Especially season one, Buck 1.0, Red Pilled Buck.
Yeah. Who has no plans for Valentine's Day, like their little date, by the way.
Yeah, this is kind of awkward. The 118 kind of start pressing them and realize that Buck and Abby have not made any plans for Valentine's Day. So they kind of like peer pressure Buck into asking her out for the night, which he does. Hen has a funny line where she's like, kind of late for a resi. She's like, how are you going to get a reservation? Buck says he knows people. So, okay, that's that. And the 118 gets a call. So they kind of have to rush off. He makes plans with Abby for like 7 that night and they decide to go out.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And leaving Abby at the station with the rest of the stragglers and Athena as well. And I guess they
Athena's also there. She's said, like, because of her home life, she's like, I picked up an extra shift. I'm trying not to think about love this year because, as we know, she's got her own drama going on with Michael.
I'm just imagining, like, the 118, like, they roll out of the station and then, like, immediately Abby pulls, like, from her bag, like, just a full bottle of white wine, and then they just crack it open together.
Oh, that would be so fun.
It would be so fun.
I'd love to queen out with those two.
We go from that to a very interesting scenario.
Yes, yes. We've got a girl with a bit of the crazy eyes on a date with her boyfriend.
I guess the theme of this episode can just be horrible men.
Yeah, it's like, don't get us wrong, this girl makes a few missteps herself.
Yeah, yeah.
In the end. But it starts with her being genuinely mistreated by this guy. Yeah. We get the impression that she's a little clingy, maybe what some people would think of as like crazy girl that this guy's dating. And so they're having dinner together at her place. She's clearly kind of got this whole night planned out. The guy doesn't seem very interested. She says this thing where she's like, we're going to do a double feature, The Notebook and Fatal Attraction. And then she's like, I'm just kidding. I hate The Notebook. Like, yas queen.
And she has like, it's like implied that she has like an itinerary to the point of like everything's like planned out on how it's supposed to go and everything. And obviously she has a very clear idea of how the evening is supposed to be in her head and everything.
She says, like, you said you didn't want to make any Valentine's Day plans, which means we get to follow my plans. Yeah. And she says, this is the part in my itinerary where you give me my gift. And he's brought her a box of chocolates, which she considers a very underwhelming gift. She's like, I thought you were going to give me diamonds. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you thought I was going to get you real diamonds? And he, crazy stuff. He starts laying it all out. He's like, okay, to be honest with you, I have another date tonight. You're not my only girlfriend. He's not even with her because he really likes her.
Yeah. This guy was being such a dick that I just wrote in my notes, she should kill him.
And great news for you, Ryan.
Yeah. She hits him over the head or whatever. And then we sort of get a noise complaint.
Yeah. Athena comes over. Somebody had called 911 saying there's something happening at my neighbor's place. I don't want to go over there myself. Athena shows up. The girl, her name's Melora. She's like, I was in a fight with my boyfriend, but he left. Athena just kind of assumes that she's just a, you know, wronged woman, which she is, but that's not the full story. Mm-hmm. Athena, you know, asks to come inside, kind of make sure she's okay. And these two have a nice moment. Athena's very kind to her, and Melora's like, you have a good heart, which will be important later.
It will. But for now, we can just take that as meaning, oh, that's kind of sweet. You know, Melora,
that's so sweet.
It's very clear she has some serious mental health issues. She has scars on her wrist. And
Athena notes that, which is kind of why she takes special attention. She's like, how about you take my card? You can call me anytime tonight. Yeah. Presumably she's worried that Melora might have a mental health crisis, which she doesn't not end up having.
Yeah.
But not in the way that Athena assumed.
We'll get into that down the road.
We'll leave it at that.
But for now, Athena leaves. She has some wine, of course. And then she takes a meat cleaver out of her little knife rack. She goes to the closet. And there we see Mr. Jerkface.
Douchebag guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then she just fucking starts cleavering the fuck out of him.
Yeah, she sort of strikes him with the cleaver off screen, and that's when we cut to Buck and Bobby at the...
I love this scene so much.
The clear dressing... dressing room. That's not what they call it.
Girl, no, the theater kid just jumped out. We can't be doing this on the pod. That can't happen again.
We are not built for... We don't know what... we don't know the word locker room. To us, that's a dressing room. You have to understand who's hosting this podcast. Mm-hmm, come on. Mm-hmm, what are we, construction workers? What do we go to the gym? Just kidding, like, go to the gym.
An incredible Freudian slip that just happened there.
You know what that was? That was like, hi, I'm Kurt Hummel and I'll be auditioning for the role of kicker. We cut to Bobby in, what I meant was, we're in the glass changing room.
The locker room with the transparent walls, right? The windows out into the floor.
Bobby is tying Buck's tie for him.
Yeah.
It's like, we get it. He's a father figure.
It's so sweet. I mean, he's like doing it like Buck's like going to homecoming, you know?
It has that vibe.
He's all dressed up with his press shirt. It's so sweet.
Buck's putting on like a full suit for this date, which is admirable.
Yeah. And then we sort of like juxtapose that with Abby getting ready, looking gorgeous in her
dress. Oh my god, she comes out in this like this little black off the shoulder kind of frilly. Mm-hmm. It's almost giving like flamenco, like kind of a Spanish influence.
Yeah.
So beautiful. Her senile mom has a great line where she says, "You don't look like a whore at all."
I that's how you know that is a moment of lucidity for her. That is the most mom shit I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah,
that is like some real shit I've like.
So Abby's like, thanks, mom.
Yeah. And Bobby, and we sort of cut back to Bobby getting Buck ready, and he basically says, you know, if you respect Abby and you want a relationship with her, you're not gonna sleep with her tonight.
We get a self-diagnosed sex addict callback.
Yes,
so
we
that's
do.
Fun.
And this is, there's sort of like a dramatic irony here, because Buck is trying not to sleep with Abby. Meanwhile, mm-hmm. Abby's kind of pent up.
Abby's kind of trying to sleep with Buck. She had a line when she was talking to Carla and her mom where she's like, honestly, I don't care that Buck's like a boy. She's kind of saying, I don't need him to be like super committed to me. I just want to put on some fancy underwear and go out and have a good time and have someone make me feel special, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're approaching this date from two different angles, and obviously it's going to go very well.
Yeah. What could possibly go wrong? So they get to the restaurant. There, we get some interesting like internal monologue moments, some internal narration, which is pretty rare for this show.
Mm-hmm.
Like occasionally they'll do sort of Grey's Anatomy style, like opening or closing narration to kind of tie in the themes of the episode. But I'm not sure they ever do, other than this episode, this type of like moment-to-moment internal dialogue.
Yeah, we don't really get voiceovers in this show much, do we? Except for like the beginning or the,
right,
I guess, the little monologues.
It's meant to show that they're, yeah, kind of both having their different insecurities. Abby, they both are like gushing over each other, but Abby's like, ooh, is he gonna get carded? That would be so embarrassing if he got mm-hmm. carded and not me.
Mm-hmm.
Buck is thinking, like, she's looks so beautiful, I can't think about having sex with her.
Yeah.
He has this line, he's trying to figure out what wine to get from the waiter, and mm-hmm. he like tries a sample of it and he says, yep, tastes like wine to me.
Tastes like wine.
That's where I wrote in my notes, he's just like me for real.
He's ordering this like a bottle of like the like a full bodied red or something like that. And as a server myself, I was just paying special attention to this waiter's wine pouring etiquette. It was quite good. You let the person who ordered the bottle taste it, and then you serve ladies first.
Wow, very nice. I'll remember that if I ever have to serve wine to people.
And so we find out that Buck got the resi because the station helped the restaurant with like a pipe explosion, or like a pipe burst or something like that.
A noxious gas leak is how he describes it.
Noxious gas leak. And since then, the manager has just kind of owed him one. Right.
Yeah.
And it looks like a really nice restaurant, like a really like fancy sit down place.
Which I think is maybe their first mistake, is they kind of maybe chose a bit too formal of an environment and they're both feeling nervous. Buck is like, do you mind if I start eating this bread that's mm-hmm. on the table?
Mm-hmm.
And Buck, I cannot stress this enough, is trying so hard to not think about having sex with Abby that he immediately chokes and almost dies. So he chokes on the bread. Abby immediately realizes what's happening. She's like, oh God, oh fuck. Mm-hmm. She gets the waiter to start doing the Heimlich maneuver. It's not working. Buck stops breathing. He passes out. She calls 911. She's like doing chest compressions. She realizes that the ambulance is not going to be there in time for how long he's stopped breathing. So she calls up like, I think she calls it, an EMD, an emergency medical something. Mm-hmm. Somebody who works at the dispatch who can like provide emergency medical instructions, basically.
Yeah.
And she's like, I need to do an emergency thoracotomy.
Tracheotomy. Thinking of
Jesus Christ, a tracheotomy. There are too many emergency otomies in the field in this show for me to keep track of. Yes, it's a tracheotomy.
Mm-hmm. And performs it. Literally just like
seamlessly
makes an incision with a steak knife in his throat.
Puts
and
like
takes
a pen in there to let the air in.
Mm-hmm. And it works. And you see Buck open his eyes. The reason he chokes on the bread is not just because he like, you know, gets lodged in his windpipe, but then he like drinks water and the bread expands and it gets lodged in there.
Yeah, this was a good lesson to me because I didn't know that could happen.
Yeah. No, it's and it's just like, man, not only could this date not possibly have gone worse, but also I wrote something crude and crass in my notes as I often do. But I saw Abby performing the tracheotomy and I went, wow. Buck really is the only one getting penetrated tonight, huh?
Well,
I'm sorry. Cut it out. Cut that out.
But I don't think I will, Ryan.
Oh no! But while this scene is going on, or maybe I think it's actually just before the scene. I think we may have jumped ahead a couple of scenes after, like the Buck getting ready scene. We get Athena's on the freeway. There's a pile up and. Like no one's injured, but there is an ambulance like transporting an organ for a transplant, right?
Yeah.
It's on Valentine's Day, and obviously they can't get through the pileup and everything. So Athena basically whisks the guy with the organ into her car, and we get just like a really cool driving scene that I'm sure is awesome for people who live in LA, of her just like swerving around traffic for like an extended like 2 minutes. With the camera following the car and everything. And they get to the hospital. And of course, we get a Seattle mention. We got St. Paul yesterday and we get Seattle today. We have a Seattle mention. Okay. Because the girl's from Seattle. And she goes, fitting, transporting a heart on Valentine's Day. And she goes, it's a kidney.
Athena goes, well, kidneys are good too.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's funny. Mm-hmm. I will say, I'm not trying to be like overly critical of everything Athena does just because she's a cop and we hate cops, but I couldn't help but think, like, I know it's just like to have a cool scene in the episode, but like, you're really putting the lives of both you and the transplant escort guy and every single person you're sharing the road with on the line to try and save this one life with the kidney. And it's like, I get it, but also like, I feel like you're putting way more people in danger by driving like 150 miles an hour through the streets of Los Angeles to get this kidney to the hospital. I heard an interesting fact recently about how apparently like a large percentage of police related deaths, civilian deaths, actually happen because of like police chases. Because like high speed police chases are extremely dangerous for just the other people on the road.
Yeah.
And so they like crash into and kill a ton of, let alone like hit pedestrians, a ton of people every year.
But like they're fucking A-Train in the first episode of The Boys with that girl standing off of the curb.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we go from that to Athena gets a call, right?
Mm-hmm.
And is the call from Melora?
I think it's like... Maybe the police got a call from Melora and they called Athena or something. I forget.
Yeah. And basically she does a wellness check on the residents. And Melora's basically just straight chilling.
Yeah, she's fine. But she's like, I wanted to thank you, Athena, for being so kind to me. I got you some chocolates. I like poured some wine for you. Athena's kind of uncomfortable.
She's lit a bunch of candles.
Yeah. Athena's like, oh, you really didn't have to do this. Melora accidentally spills some wine on her. It's kind of going badly. Athena's like, okay, I am just going to clean up in the bathroom and then I'm going to go because this isn't really appropriate. So yeah. Athena goes to the bathroom. She notices that this woman has like a million different prescription drug containers in the bathroom, you know, medicine cabinet, which kind of a classic tired, unfortunate thing in media when you just say like, oh, person is medicated for mental illness. I guess they're a crazy, murderous psycho.
Yeah. But the thing that really tips her off is like when like Melora's like telling her where everything is. And she says the ammonia works really well on blood. And she takes a moment to like stop.
Right. There are some other clues. And then Athena happens to look in the shower and there's like blood in the shower drain.
And it's like a moment of like realizing she's in Buffalo Bill's house and she needs to get out.
I honestly, I just want to say I loved this whole storyline throughout the episode. Like as a horror fan, as a slasher fan, I just thought it was so fun that they kind of made this entire like little mini episode about this girl and her murderous intentions.
Yeah, you can see
Athena having to figure her way out of it.
You can see a lot of the DNA of their past projects in this episode because Tim, he started working with Brad and Ryan Murphy on American Horror Story.
Right.
And that was like how they started working together, I believe. And so like with his background in horror and with all three of them, their background in horror, it just kind of, it makes sense that they would lean into something as, I guess, ridiculous and sort of sensational as this.
And morbid. And it kind of has that that vibe of, you know, on American Horror Story when it's like sometimes it's serious, but a lot of the time it's kind of campy on purpose. And it's like very sensational and kind of funny in a dark way.
Yeah, definitely. And then Athena starts looking through the doors in the house, all the rooms at... As one does when you're in a horror scenario like this. And she finds the dismembered and super glued back together corpse of Mr. Douchebag.
Yes, Mr. Douchebag has been cleaved into pieces and then Melora has super glued him back together. Mm. Melora, at this point, comes up behind Athena, hits her over the head, right?
Yeah.
Or no,
no, she has a gun. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She has like a revolver or like holds it to like the back of her neck or something.
Very dramatic.
And then we get the dinner scene.
Yeah, I guess we forgot that was two separate scenes.
We get I guess that is a big tone shift going from Athena doing that to the dinner scene into the next call as well. It's interesting how the show balances that. Because the pieces do feel, I guess, a little bit more incongruous in this episode than maybe they do in others.
Right. I mean, this is an episode with a lot of tone shifts, you could say.
Yeah.
Although it's like I said, the murdering sequences are also treated kind of lighthearted, so it doesn't feel too crazy. But it does like definitely the stakes. There's a shift in stakes that feels a little weird. So we go from that to 911 call, somebody has like fallen off of the roof or something, and he's speaking in hushed tones on the call. Bobby and Chimney show up, they go to the house that they were told to go to, and it's just like a woman and her boyfriend, and they're like, no, nothing's wrong here, we haven't seen anything. We find out that the woman was expecting to be alone on Valentine's Day, but her boyfriend came home early, which surprised her. So that's kind of the one detail we get. Bobby's like, okay, can we just take a look around? They do. And in the yard, they find a man who has jumped off the balcony and broken both legs.
Yeah. And I mean, it's this classic scenario, right? Van Nuys, rich lady, presumably having an affair. And when husband comes home, boyfriend jumps off the balcony. It's a classic setup.
Right. They tell him he has a what they call a Casanova fracture, which is when a lover, you know, runs away from the husband or whatever and jumps off of something, gets a fracture.
But then
the twist.
they flip it on its head and they reveal that actually the guy who jumped off the roof is the current and soon to be ex-husband of the woman. And the guy who came home was the lover turned
new boyfriend.
Right.
The husband and wife are separated, and so you know you get the boyfriend being like, "You said it was over between the two of you.
You asked me to move in." Like, but they just got their spark reignited on Valentine's Day. Something
their
happened.
Spark reignited. There was, I think, there was an episode of Grey's Anatomy with kind of a similar thing. Actually, I think what I'm thinking of, it's like a couple comes into the ER and they're like, they were like having sex and they got stuck, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah. And I remember that episode.
Do you remember? Turns out that they are like doing, they're either divorced or like in the middle of divorce proceedings, but they like can't stop like getting back together, like kind of by accident. And now they're in this situation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is honestly just like, I was just watching and I was trying to untangle their situation in my mind. And I was just thinking, there are just some situations that you just don't want to get in the middle of.
Mm-hmm. It's, you know, they match each other's freak, it seems like.
Definitely, definitely. And so, like, I think the 118 had a similar reaction. And so they whisked, I believe Mickey was his name, off to the hospital. And they kind of professed their love for each other. And, you know, I was just sitting there watching, like, y'all need to figure this out. Take me back to Athena Grant, please, please.
Well, you know, it's like in episode one when Bobby teaches Buck the lesson of like, once we get to the hospital, we hand them off. It's sort of like in this situation, like you just deal with the call, the emotional conflict between the people you're responding to. You got to hand that off, too. It's not your problem.
If I was them, I would have wanted to hand it off in the field. I would have just been like, nope.
Not my problem.
No.
You take him to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was also reminded, actually, I'm sorry, I keep bringing up season 8, but I was also reminded of in like our most recent episode, as of recording this, episode 6, there was a call they responded to where like these two people are getting a divorce and hate each other. And the guy has a problem where he sneezes every time he lies.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And he sneezes so many times, he like has an old incision open up and like his guts fly out.
His guts
it's
fly
an insane
out.
Shot. He like herniates basically, and in like a extremely severe way. And they have kind of a similar thing where like these two people hate each other, but then suddenly by the end of the call, it's like they're sort of like reconnecting, and you can see everybody else there is like like similar thing where it's like two crazy toxic people matching each other's freak.
He says he loves her and he doesn't sneeze, and she's like, you didn't sneeze. You didn't sneeze when you said you loved me.
So romantic.
So romantic. There really is someone for everyone. speaking of Athena, we cut back to her and she's all tied up at work.
Ba-doom-ts. Yeah, that was exactly.
Thank you. Thank you for acknowledging my pun. I wrote it down. I was very proud of myself for it. So thank you.
She's been tied up by Melora. She's sitting there on a chair. Melora reveals her dastardly plan, which is Athena has such a good heart. And the problem with douchebag guy is that he was, you know, he was handsome. He had a good job. The sex was great, she says. But he just had a bad heart. He didn't have a good heart, so what she's gonna do is take out Athena's heart and give it to douchebag guy, who is very much dead at this point. But, you know, this girl's a little bit off her rocker, clearly. Yeah.
She's like, she wants to be, like, an American Frankenstein. But, like, my question with, like, the heart storyline is, did she have to cut him up for that?
You know, we can't pretend to know the goings-on of the inner workings of Melora's twisted mind.
Can I know Tim Minear's?
No. No, heart emoji. It's sort of like in a story like this, they sort of give themselves the lazy out of like, any question you could possibly have can just be explained away by, well, she's crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, Athena's trying to reason with her. She says a very interesting line where she goes, the system can go easy on a woman scorned, but not on one who hurts a cop.
I'm glad you brought it up, because that line is, again, a very, like, revealing moment.
Yeah.
Where you're like, the system can go easy on a woman who cuts up a guy and super glues him back together, but don't you dare touch a cop.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, oh my god, that line. I cringed like twice in one line, because like, first of all, like the fucking like hell hath no fury like a woman scorned thing, which is so tired. But then like, just like, oh god, stop with the goddamn cop again. Come on, guys, stop.
Unfortunately, it's only going to get worse as the show goes on.
I know. It's not like SVU where like it's a cop show, so you just like you put it on and you're just like, I know what to expect. Let me just turn that part of my brain off and just watch a rapist go to prison, you know? it just comes out of nowhere sometimes, you know?
It does.
It's so frustrating.
It's almost like they have like a quota where like they have to shoehorn in some cop worship every episode or they'll get fired. Well, on a lighter note, I have some fact checking for some things Athena says in this scene.
Okay. Let's get into it.
Yeah, I think I told you the other day, I have like a couple different like information rabbit holes I went on in this episode. One is at the very end and one is here. So Athena starts telling Melora, she's like, do you know about the real history of Valentine's Day? Mm-hmm. And she says that she knows about this because her daughter May did a school report on it.
Mm-hmm.
Which, to be fair, any inaccuracies in this monologue could simply be that her only source is May's school project. And May might have just gotten a few things wrong because she's a high schooler. So this isn't, this is just, I was curious. So I decided to see what the real deal is.
Mm-hmm.
So Athena starts referencing this ancient Roman festival ritual called Lupercalia. And specifically, she describes it as it was a pagan ritual to Lupercalia, which I believe is not accurate. The festival was called Lupercalia, and it's kind of disputed, like, what deity, if any, this was supposed to be, like, honoring.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say that it was, like, named for a Roman god. Other people say that, like, there's not any one deity that's been identified that would be associated with this. Mm-hmm. Some people think it's related to wolves, including perhaps the she-wolf who nursed Romulus and Remus in Roman mythology. So, you know, Alexa, play She-Wolf by Shakira.
Our favorite song.
Our favorite song. Basically, Athena describes this as like they would have naked men chasing women through the streets, hitting them, which was supposed to fix them and make them fertile and help them find a husband. And then they would sacrifice a dog. So I had to look into it. I had to find out if this was true. So for the record, it sounds like they would actually sacrifice the dog before running through the streets beating women.
Okay. So the beating women and running through the streets is real.
Well, so here's what they would do. They would sacrifice goats and a dog. Mm-hmm. Then they would do this whole thing where they would have like these priests go to an altar. They would be like anointed with the bloody sacrifice knife. They would have a big sacrificial feast and they would cut strips of skin from the sacrificial animals and then like run around hitting. Britannica describes this as they would hit any woman who came near them, which I thought was kind of an interesting distinction because it implies less that they were chasing women down and more that it was maybe more of a voluntary thing where, like, you would approach them if you wanted to be hit with the fertility whip.
Mm-hmm.
But sources vary on, like, whether this was, like, a sadistic, misogynistic thing or more of, like, a mutually participatory fertility thing. Some people think it was just a weird sex thing. but...
Was it compulsory or was it, like... Were you able to opt out?
It's hard to say. Like, from the women's perspective, it sounds like most people are more aware of just what these priests would do and not so much like the women's participation in it. Yeah, it seems like it's not clear if they were like forced to or not.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, it's interesting that Athena mentions like they thought it would help them find a husband, because I did find some sources that kind of claim that there was like a matchmaking element, but not everyone is in agreement on that. It's really basically just a lot of these facts are disputed because I guess you have like a lot of unreliable sources from like throughout history that were kind of just guessing from what other people had said. And anyway, there have been a lot of the main thing I want to take issue with here is the assertion that this is the quote real history of Valentine's Day, because this is a claim that has been made a lot throughout history. And it seems like really the only connection is that Lupercalia would be held from like February 13th to the 15th. So right around the same time of year as the modern Valentine's Day. But it seems like the actual connection between the two is pretty tenuous. This practice was outlawed in like 494 CE.
Yeah.
And from what I could find, most historians think that like the first practice of Valentine's Day in like a romantic love way as we know it today is from like the 14th century. So that's like a really big gap in time between the
yeah,
two.
Yeah, it's like 1,000 years.
Yeah, so it kind of seems like the only historians who have made a connection, or not even historians, but just like pop culture has made this connection. It seems like it's a common like folk belief that there's a connection, but it seems basically only based in the idea that they were both celebrations that happened around the same time of year. And it just came about because it's like sensational to pretend that there's like a sadistic ancient Roman pagan practice. You know, it's kind of like people love to do that with holidays.
Yeah.
They love to pretend that like Christmas or Halloween has like a really like creepy origin, like even if that's not entirely true.
Yeah. I think there's also maybe like an aesthetic element, because there was in like its own way kind of a seemingly like symbolically like romantic or sexual aspect to mm-hmm. this pagan tradition that happened around the same time as Valentine's Day, that it's like sort of like an interesting like sort of sensational idea that that's where the holiday came from, right? It would be like, yeah. I guess if that's accurate, which I don't doubt that it is, then it would be like sort of akin to like saying the Mexican holiday of Dia de los Muertos is the inspiration for the American tradition of Halloween. Mm-hmm. Even though we know the origins of Halloween, which is from Ireland, and like
yeah, and it's like, just kind of like one of these pop,
just because it's like death related and happens in the fall, you know, near each other.
Yeah, it's just like kind of a pseudo historical thing that people have come to believe. I found there was like this Yale historian who did a big interview with NPR in like 2011 where he like asserted a connection like as if it was fact. And it kind of seems like that is where most of the modern like belief that this is definitely connected comes from. I would assume that's where the 911 episode got this information.
That's where Meg Grant got the information.
Yeah, for sure.
Kind of a heavy subject for Meg Grant's school project, by the way.
It is, but you know, she's also like tormented this year. You know, she really was in a lot of anguish mentally, so I get it. It's like sometimes you want to look at that morbid stuff when you're having a hard time. But I just wanted to point it out because it's like, yeah, it doesn't really matter, but I also am a big fan of like doing the research, and I feel like even little facts matter, you know.
It's they
like
do.
It matters to really get to the truth and not just take somebody's word for it, which like I'm not saying I like scanned a few online sources, like mm-hmm. I don't know for sure, but from what I can tell, this whole claim that they're like definitely related to each other is not likely the case.
Yeah, you're a crusader for truth.
I also wanted to take note of Athena's line where she says, you know, the woman says, that's wrong. Like Valentine's Day is based on Saint Valentine, who was the patron saint of love. And then Athena says he was the patron saint of epileptics. Which I looked it up. For the record, he is both. He's the patron saint of lovers and epileptics and, get this, beekeepers.
Hey! And it all comes back around.
It all comes back around. Isn't that beautiful?
It is. Melora, I will say, and not to take a hard right on the conversation or anything, but
no, well, go ahead.
I just want to like take a moment to do a little psychological investigating of Melora's brain, because she's an interesting character. I mean, like, she obviously she has her issues. Mm-hmm. And obviously like you can't diagnose someone through a screen, but I think what's interesting about her is that because, you know, she isn't just like this sort of like psychopathic killer or whatever, or this sort of like this abused person whose mind sort of breaks in a psychotic episode. Like, she also like suffers from this like paranoia that stops her from like empathizing with other people, or like sympathizing with other women. And so not only does she kill her man, but then she takes his phone and texts his other girlfriend to meet mm-hmm. him at hers, and then kidnaps her and stuffs her in the basement because she doesn't see her as a victim of this guy either. She sees, if anything, she sees her as like a co-conspirator in this grand plot against her.
Yeah, she's not being a great feminist. Yeah.
And so Melor is about to cut Athena's heart out and put it in her body. The guy's body, Ted is his name, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then she gets a knock at the door, or like a doorbell ringing. And yes. Then
saved by the bell, Athena, the
guy
again.
Saved by the bell, and lo and behold, the guy's third girlfriend shows up at the house.
This bastard of a man. It's like at this point you're like, well, maybe he kind of deserved it.
Yeah, but that, like, the ring of the doorbell causes her to hesitate. Athena breaks free of her duct tape binds and basically rocks Melora's shit and knocks her to the ground, and you know, just gets her ass, and then she goes to answer the door, and this woman is just furious.
Yeah, she's like, Ted told me to meet him at whatever, and he never turned off his location sharing, so I'm here to find out where he is. And, you know, Athena kind of dryly explains the situation to her, goes down to the basement, grabs the second girlfriend who's tied up down there. And, you know, she's like, I, you saved me, basically, angry woman who came to the door.
Yeah, so I don't know, what's the context of this? And I'm going to ask you the context of this. When does ketamine come into the conversation again?
Is it when Athena requests backup and she says, bring a straitjacket and some horse tranquilizer?
Oh, exactly. That's exactly what it is. She goes, bring a straitjacket and some horse tranquilizer. And I went, oh, some K. It's for her. She had a long day.
Yeah, she could have just said... she could have just said ketamine.
Yeah. But yeah, just, I think the moral of this story... I don't think there is a moral of this story, honestly. But if there is one, I guess it's just...
To quote Styles from Teen Wolf... Ketamine. The man needs ketamine.
The man needs ketamine. A part of me does, like, feel bad for Melora, obviously, because she is mentally unwell, of course. I don't know. I honestly don't know if I have a conclusion to draw from this storyline other than I love horror stuff, and so this was just a fun addition to the episode.
I mean, honestly, when you think of, like, American Horror Story, though, isn't that sometimes kind of how that show feels, where it's like, there's not always, like, a great grand message. It's kind of just like, would that be fucked up or what, you know?
yeah. But that's fun for that reason, too. You know, like, you're watching, like, the hotel season, and you get to the end, and you're like, man, Gaga looks so good. But after Melora is, I guess, taken away, and she gets the straitjacket and the horse tranquilizer, one of the cops says to Athena, go home and see your husband. There's still a couple hours of Valentine's Day left. And I just had to say, bro, he's with his husband.
Yeah, Michael is definitely on a date right now.
Meanwhile, Athena's still like on her shift and everything. And it's like, I feel so bad for her. I really do.
Yeah. But I mean, then we have, Buck, Abby, and Bobby at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Buck is unconscious. I wanted to say earlier about this whole choking thing, just like, you know, milestone, Buck's first near-death experience on this show. First of many. So everybody, you know, give it up for that.
Yeah. And everybody clapped.
Very fun. But we get a little Bobby and Abby moment. And listen, I have a bit of a nuclear take to give right here.
Let's hear it.
Something that might be controversial. Is it weird that from this episode, I feel like you would think that they were maybe trying to set up Bobby and Abby? You still with me?
Jane.
Think about it.
Jane.
I'm not saying it was intentional. I just think it's kind of odd that this episode has, like, a few different beats that kind of feel like that. In the opening... Not the opening, but the first scenes we get with both Abby and Bobby separately. Abby is expressing how she loves Valentine's Day. She feels like other people don't. She really is wishing Buck would care about Valentine's Day. We cut to Buck and Bobby. Buck doesn't care about Valentine's Day, but Bobby also expresses that he's always loved Valentine's Day and that he misses his wife. And it almost feels, you know, like, why leave that breadcrumb in this episode, right? Bobby needs someone, and he and Abby both love Valentine's Day. Then Bobby is the one to first see Abby in the fire station at Chimney's party. He sees her. They sort of have a little awkward moment. There's just something about it, like the fact that they would have Bobby go down to receive her instead of like her just walk into the party. And then in this scene, they're like, Buck is there, but it kind of feels like Abby and Bobby are really connecting and they're like closer to each other in age. He like, you know, offers to go get coffee for her. They actually, okay, symbolism, I'm just saying, they leave Buck to go get coffee together. Like, it's not like he goes and gets coffee for both of them. They actually both get up and leave.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my case for just if I could see like an alternate universe where someone on this show was like gunning for Abby and Bobby. I know it's weird. And I know that like this is blasphemy for me to even say. I know who they were ultimately setting up Bobby with. But it's interesting that in this one isolated episode, it almost feels like to me they're trying to set it up.
Okay. do you remember that post that was like, if ever you're not sure about an allegation of queerbaiting, ask yourself, if they were a man and a woman, would this be read as romantic, right? Like that sort of that axiom, mm-hmm. right? What's like the extreme opposite of that? Like, if ever you're wondering if two straight people are platonic, ask yourself if it was two men or two women, would it be read as anything other than pure colleagues and coworkers?
Well, the joke's on you. I can make any two men or two women seem like they're going to be romantic in my imagination.
I mean, listen, respect, I have, you know, I've been there, but like, I'm
not saying I like ship it, okay? Okay. I'm just trying to call attention to like writing wise, I feel like they accidentally put some clues in this episode as if they were setting up Bobby and Abby, and it just occurred to me while watching this time, and I thought it was interesting.
I support women. I
listen. People aren't ready for the hotness of my takes. They're not ready for the.
I would never want to silence a woman's voice. And so I'm just going to sit here and I'm just going to nod.
They're not ready for right the now. Astuteness of my observations, of my analysis. You know, a lot of great scholars are ahead of their time and people might call them crazy at first,
mm-hmm.
but they just need, eventually everyone's going to agree with me.
Well, I just want to call attention to a line Bobby says after Abby says something and he goes, spoken like a true first responder. And I just wrote down,
yeah.
Spoken like a true first respodcast.
Hell yeah. We could say that in the future whenever either of us has an ice cold take.
Spoken like a true first respodcast.
Yeah.
Oh, I...
Okay, we can move on from this. what comes next? We get...
It's the last scene. It's the last scene.
Athena comes home after all this kind of rough day and not being in the mood for Valentine's Day. She finds that her kids have left out for her this cute little plate of heart-shaped cookies they've presumably made.
And a glass of wine. Of course.
This is an adorable gesture, but I do have to ask, how long do you think that glass of wine was sitting out, becoming tepid?
Oh, God. What, do you think it's just, like, fully vinegarized by now? Like,
well, like, they're kids, you know? So I was thinking, like, they probably wouldn't know that, like, you shouldn't just, like, leave a glass of wine out for hours on end.
Yeah.
So I was kind of wondering.
I mean, she does go to take a sip of it, and then I think we'd see her take another sip, so it's probably fine. Okay. But
maybe they, like, timed it to do it right before she got home.
Maybe. Or maybe leaving the card on top of the glass, like, insulated it in some way. I don't know. So it wasn't as
right.
aerolized or... oxygenized or whatever.
But at this point, finally, this was my other information rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
Did you take note at all of the song that's playing during this scene?
I did not. What song
is it?
It's a song. Oh, it's a song.
It's a song called Heartbeats by an artist named Jose Gonzalez. This is a cover of a sort of like electro pop song from the 2000s by like a Swedish duo. Anyway, it's like an indie soft boy cover of it, though, sure. Right?
Yeah.
And I heard this playing in the episode, and I was like, I recognize this. And not only did I recognize it, I felt like I had just heard it in a different TV show, like in the last few days. So I was thinking about what I'd been watching. I've been watching the first few episodes of this medical drama called New Amsterdam. Have you heard of this?
Yes, I have. I think I've seen New Amsterdam. I think I've seen like one episode.
Yeah. I've been watching like the first few episodes. Somebody recommended it to me on my Patreon, and I'm looking for like new stupid TVs to watch, TV shows to watch.
My friend told me that that show was like very pro like Medicare for All, just in its like subtext and its framing and everything. Which is good.
It's very interested in like the kind of bureaucracy, like messing up healthcare. Mm-hmm. But I would say it's like just okay, at least so far. Like it hasn't really rocked my world, but I was pretty sure I had heard this song in an episode of New Amsterdam. So I kind of went through the IMDb soundtrack entries for the first few episodes. And mm-hmm. sure enough, this song plays at one point in season one, episode three of New Amsterdam. So, okay, mystery solved. Mm-hmm. But I, for some reason, it sounded like more familiar than just once.
Right.
So I decided to look up the song in general. I looked up like this song uses in TV. There's like a website. There's a website called What Song where you can see this stuff. People vlogged it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I just want to read you a list of all of the TV shows in which this song has appeared. Okay. Are you ready?
Oh, my God. I'm ready.
It appeared in one episode of Scrubs.
Okay.
Not one, but two episodes of One Tree Hill.
Nice.
One episode of Bones.
Okay.
One episode of Brothers and Sisters, which I don't even really know what that is.
I think I saw ads for that.
Yeah. It says 2006. Yeah. One episode of 90210.
Right. Mm-hmm. The reboot, I think.
Yeah, yeah. One episode of Covert Affairs.
Okay.
Not one, but two episodes of Superstore. One episode of Tell Me Lies. And you're never going to believe this, Ryan.
Okay.
Not one, but two episodes of 911.
Two?
This song plays in season one, episode six, and it also plays, totally unrelated, in season five, episode 12.
What?
The Boston episode. I went back through this episode on Hulu to confirm. It plays just in a, again, totally unrelated scene, not like a callback or anything.
Yeah.
So presumably they just forgot that they had already used it.
Oh my God.
This song is up there with like How to Save a Life terms of TV usage. I think it's actually been used more than How to Save a Life.
Right. Because there's only so many doctor shows, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like this, I just wanted to point this out because this is crazy to me. Like this is the song that has been in every show.
And we're getting it now.
and like 911 double dipped.
You know what's funny about that? Because like I've seen this show all the way through. I'm caught mm-hmm. up on the show. I've seen 90210. I've seen One Tree Hill. I've seen Bones. I've seen like a lot of those shows. And I could not tell you a single thing about this song. I couldn't hum the tune. I couldn't name a single lyric. I don't even remember what the title was.
Heartbeats. It's called Heartbeats. It's that song that's like, One Night to Be Confused.
It's missing. I'm not getting anything. It sounds like every song that played on the Vampire Diaries. Like,
true. Maybe that's why they keep using it, is they know that it's generic enough to hit the same every time.
Wow. Well, good for those guys for getting that TV bag. I'm sure their residual checks are fantastic.
I know. Must be crazy. To be fair, I also found like an entire article somebody had written about the fact that this song is used in everything. And that author also pointed out that it was also used in This Is Us, which I guess has not been updated on this What Song list.
Wow.
So that's another one. It was also in This Is Us.
Okay. We're gonna slowly like find out more shows that it was in. Like it was in The Resident, and it was in like FBI and the Clarice show that they made.
Right. Because that makes me think, right, that like, okay, if the This Is Us usage isn't on here, then this must not be a complete list, which is frightening.
The fact that that list is non-comprehensive, it's just like we need a formal investigation akin to like those videos about like who won the Danimals sweepstakes. Like, we need to track this song down.
Is Heartbeats by Jose Gonzalez being astroturfed into the public consciousness via network television?
Wow.
But that about wraps it up, doesn't it?
It does. It does. The episode ends, and it's a very sort of, like, sweet but also, like, sad note. It's interesting where it's like we finally get, like, a moment of rest on this show after this episode.
Mm-hmm.
It's like
the coming home at the end of the day moment.
Yeah, it's like for the first time in a while we haven't been left on a big cliffhanger or a story beat hanging over. It's just like, you know, Buck's in the hospital,
or,
but he'll
be fine. Or,
you know,
Buck and Abby phone sex.
Buck and Abby phone sex. Like, it's literally just like a moment of unwinding in the middle of the season, which feels honestly necessary because we are at episode mm-hmm. 6 and it's been very high octane so far. And so I think the characters definitely, but also we as the audience need a moment to kind of recalibrate here.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a good episode. I was thoroughly entertained.
Again, it kind of just like novel in the sense that we haven't gotten any other Valentine's Day episodes. And you know what I was going to say earlier is, you know, like on Gravity Falls when, you know, that show only aired like in the summer or it was only taking place in the summer.
Yeah.
So as an excuse to have a Halloween episode, they just made up that this town of Gravity Falls has like a summer-ween.
Yeah.
They should do that for 911 and just come up with like a contrived reason for them mm-hmm. to be celebrating Valentine's Day outside of actual Valentine's Day.
Like how Hallmark will like air all their Christmas movies, like do like a Christmas in July.
Right, Christmas in July.
Yeah.
Yeah. Valentine's Day in April.
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. V-Day in September. The new like, month of love. They could have an autumn of love, one could say. You know,
autumn of love.
Autumn
that
of
sounds
love.
Like the title of a Hallmark movie.
It does, actually. It's set in the 60s. but she's rejecting the hippie culture because she's too much of a patriot.
Right, right. And, she believes in God too much.
And therefore virtuous. I will say, you know, I wasn't expecting to walk away from this season just like as big of an Abby stan as I am.
But I'm glad we're getting there, you know, like having that journey.
I love this diva. I love her. I love her clothes. I love her storyline with her mom and with Buck. And I love her so much. I love her world. I love her wine. I love everything about her.
She's kind of the greatest. And it's not that I think people aren't allowed to like her, but I definitely have like a more skeptical view now of like fans who are really adamantly against Abby. I'm like, are you really feeling that way, like because of what was shown to you in the text, or is it more of like a personal kind of motivated thing? But again, it's like you're allowed to dislike her for like your own reasons. It's just this sort of big fandom movement of dislike against her feels not really motivated by what we've actually seen in the show.
I want to reiterate, I get what it's like to be in a fandom where you share opinions with people who you would not otherwise associate with. You know, I get it. It's a tough life. Try defending Batman v Superman on the internet in 2017. I was in the trenches. Okay. And
so we get back to Zack Snyder.
Oh my God. No, we need to keep that out of this podcast. We need to keep it out.
Don't say it. Don't think it.
Don't see no evil. Hear no evil. Speak no evil. Regrettably, I do love that man and his movies. What I'm saying is, listen, Abby haters, I get it. Live your life. Just make sure that, you know, the reason you're disliking her is divorced from any sort of misogynistic tendencies that tend to run rampant in fandom spaces, and we'll all have a good chill time. You know?
And no one will get cut up into pieces and super glued back together.
Yeah. Well, maybe some people, but not you guys. It'll be fine.
Never you guys, people listening to this podcast.
No, not our listeners.
Not our listeners.
Is it us? Are we the murderers? I don't
Are
think
we
we're
the
murderers. I don't think we're the drama. And with that, thank you for listening to the First Verse podcast. Find us on social media. linked in the description.
Yeah, I've started linking it in the description, finally.
We love to plug, but we can't plug every time. You know who we are, you know where to find us.
Listen to our hot bonus episode that at this point we will have released like 2 weeks ago, but yep. little season 8 bonus episode. Maybe mm-hmm. by this point we'll even have recorded more bonus episodes, who's to say? Depends on how many dramatic things happen in the conclusion of season 8A of this show.
We're crossing our fingers, boys. We're crossing our fingers, buddies. All right. Good night, beautiful people. Thank you for listening. And
but be nice to women.
Be nice to women. Listen, if you don't...
There might be consequences in your life.
Listen.
There are some people out here, especially in this day and age, who are just right on the verge of snapping.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We got a lot of Maloras in the world right now. Okay? So just... That's all I have to say about that.
I can probably just kind of fade out on one of those.